You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
What if Drew Brees opts out all of a sudden and goes and takes his job as being Notre Dame color commentator 1 year early?
I'm excited to see Drew Brees as the Notre Dame color commentator.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I'm almost wondering, is it because we've talked about all these guys that are opting out. At some point here, I feel like the biggest names, and there haven't been any gigantically big names yet, but I wonder if there is going to be at least one gigantic name. If it was a quarterback, if it was Drew Brees, I'd feel awful for it. Yeah. Well, I say I'd feel awful. I think there's a certain percentage of people there that are convinced that somehow Taysom Hill's going to be the next
Drew
Brees.
That's so true.
Yeah.
The biggest name to opt out so far, Seth, probably what? Dante Hightower?
I think so.
Dante Hightower, the big name. Nate Solder yesterday.
He's a big name, but he's not, you know, he's not the player he used to be.
Yeah. Solder you're talking about or Hightower?
Yeah, Solder.
Yeah, Solder opting out. You brought this up. The way this year is constructed, you haven't brought it up on air yet, but I know you brought it up privately, that Bill O'Brien, say what you will, you can criticize him for a lot of things, game management, criticize his moves as a general manager. The one thing that I think has been a plus with Bill O'Brien, going back to Penn State, is he does do a pretty good job that when his team, his program, his franchise's back is against the wall in some way, he does get guys to play hard. He can be resourceful. We saw that his first couple years here with the Texans. And I think, Seth, this is going to be a season where, because you're going to see a lot more guys hit the injured list than you did before because of the coronavirus, because it's a different kind of year, that maybe Bill O'Brien, and this is your point, that, so I'm going to let you elaborate on it, but that Bill O'Brien's resourcefulness might be a plus for the Texans.
Well, yeah, and I think back to just the Penn State situation, really, when I think one of the most impressive things somebody's done off the field in sports in the last couple decades was Bill O'Brien convincing as many players to stick around as they did when he took over at Penn State, you know, and all those kids had the opportunity and ability to walk away and to step onto another program without, you know, being punished whatsoever for transferring or anything. And O'Brien, for all of whatever any of his weaknesses are, I think he does a pretty damn good job of rallying the troops when your backs are against the wall, you know, and he's done it on this team several times. You think about back in 2015 when the season got off to such a miserable start, it looked like people might get fired at the bye week, and they turned around and rallied and did a pretty good job of it. You know, yeah. At the other end of the spectrum, okay, how do you do in the playoffs and everything? That's a whole other story. But I think he does a good job with that. Versus, say, like Bill Belichick, and what is Bill Belichick known for? Not his human side, not his pep talks, to be sure. And I think I don't think it's any coincidence necessarily that so many guys have stepped away from the Patriots program right now. A couple of them have been, you know, obvious medical situations. But I think at least part of it is that Belichick does not have a human touch. He's really, really good at what he does, but he does not have a human touch. And now that he can't point to, hey, look, I treat Brady like this, so it's cool that I treat all of you like this.
Yeah.
I think there's a chance that he might lose control and lose his grip on that team a little bit. I think with O'Brien, it's not like O'Brien needs to cajole anybody into sticking around. We've already lost one player, a backup defensive lineman, to the opt-out. But I think that O'Brien just kind of on keeping a focus and saying, hey, look, here's the challenge. We're going to attack this challenge. We're going to do it better than other teams in the league, and we're going to keep each other safe and keep each other eligible to play. I think it might end up being an advantage for the Texans this year. And I'll say that, like, despite whatever any of my other misgivings are about Bill O'Brien, I think that he might end up doing a really, really good job compared to some other coaches who we see coaches openly whining about the precautions that the NFL is taking. That's the wrong tactic to have right now. You can't spend your time picketing the league offices over something that's going to happen anyway. Just go ahead and view it as an obstacle that needs to be overcome. I think Bill's done a good job with that.
Text message, Sean, you were delusional, but I can appreciate your bias. Did I say anything delusional when you were asking me about my feelings about Notre Dame and the ACC and their independence today? I think the only thing that could be construed as delusional would be my take that all five Power Five conferences would be falling over themselves to get Notre Dame as a conference member. I don't think that's delusional one bit.
That's a financial thing.
Yes.
Those are just numbers. That's that Notre Dame is going to bring eyeballs
right.
to a whole bunch of it. If Notre Dame joined the Big 12 tomorrow, they would bring a whole bunch of eyeballs to Big 12 games.
Yeah.
And that means more TV money. So, yeah, everybody gets richer.
Yeah.
They would be. That's not delusional at all.
No. So, yeah, 2417 guy, just text back and let me know what exactly I'm delusional about. I didn't sit here and say they're going to win the college football playoff or anything. Although they have won double-digit games each of the last 3 years. But I need to know what I was delusional about so I don't offend your sensibilities again. All right, Joe Kelly. Suspended for 8 games. Did Major League Baseball get it right? That's next. I asked the question, did Major League Baseball get it right suspending Joe Kelly for 8 games for throwing at Alex Bregman, Carlos Correa, all the other stuff that he's done? And text message, yeah, they got it right. They should not allow headhunting under any reason. We are people before athletes. The mental gymnastics used to think this is okay is akin to the gymnastics used to justify evil against others. It's pathetic. That's a pretty deep text right there. But I do say, Seth, that I don't agree with the people who say, well, it's an 8-game suspension, and now because they're only playing 60 games, that's like they suspended him for 22 games. You know, something like that can't be done within the context of the percentage of the season. Something like that has to be done within the context of what that punishment means in terms of pay and missed time to that player.
Yeah, are we going to start just extrapolating everything out in such a way?
By 2.7?
Every punishment, every reward, everything needs to be either multiplied or divided by a factor of 2.7.
Yeah.
Just get the hell over it, okay? Yeah, Manfred is, as much as you might dislike Manfred, let's call him the commissioner. The commissioner of any sports league can't decide that one player trying to do bodily harm to another. And let's remember, Joe Kelly threw at the heads of Alex Bregman and Carlos Correa.
Right.
You can say, okay, it's not like Joe Kelly was exhibiting great control at that moment in time. So the fact that it wasn't, and I get tired of seeing, he threw over their heads. Yeah, it was over their heads because they ducked. It wasn't like it was only over by the time the ball got there. So he was throwing at their heads. That somehow the commissioner is supposed to just allow vigilantism in those circumstances because Joe Kelly was doing it to meanies who had cheated in 2017. It doesn't make any logical sense. Nobody that's saying it has actually thought it out one bit. They're just angry and they're kicking and they're screaming and they can't handle the fact that their respective team, whoever their team might be, has had other things that have kept them from winning championships in the last.
Are you cool with 8 games or should it be more than 8 games?
No, 8's good. He got fined. Look, he got suspended 6 games already for in 2018. For the Yankees deal there for throwing at a player. And so he's going to get 2 more. He's going to appeal it. I hope the appeal gets turned down.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope everybody continues to get upset that somehow baseball, I can't believe baseball is suspending a guy for throwing at 2 human beings' heads. What are you saying here? What are you even saying here? So what are you saying? Are you saying the punishment for the Astros cheating should have been that all the players should line up and have baseballs rifled at their heads?
Kind of.
I don't think that's the society we want to live in.
No.
I kind of do. But I don't think that's what we want as humans.
Yeah. So I think there's this feeling around baseball after the sign-stealing punishment was handed down and most of baseball thought it wasn't stiff enough. And then after yesterday where it seems like anybody who doesn't root for the Astros feels like the Astros are getting some sort of protection from Rob Manfred. I think it's odd because I think most Astros fans hate Rob Manfred as much as the rest of baseball does. And I think a lot of Astro fans hate him because of the way he handled the sign-stealing scandal that maybe the Astros were singled out. And that while however you feel about the punishment is how you feel about the punishment, the fact of the matter is the Astros got by far the stiffest of those punishments. So I think nobody likes Manfred in this thing. So maybe what we're hearing today here in The Athletic is going to solve some of these things. Seth, this is a bit of news. Major League Baseball and the MLBPA have agreed that players who steal signs electronically can now be suspended without pay or service time, The Athletic has learned. MLB's rules on the use of electronics and video grew significantly in the wake of the Astros and Red Sox sign-stealing scandals, according to a review of the document by The Athletic and conversations with officials familiar with it. The league has newly hired an outside security firm to police the video replay room entrance, and no later than next year plans to edit out the signs from the footage players look at in-game. So I'm assuming that means some sort of...
There's going to be a black box over it.
Or digital, you know, sort of digitally scramble it or something
they
like
that. They said a black box.
Is that what they said? Okay, I didn't see that. Gotcha. Okay. But no alternative may be as significant as the league's ability to discipline. Manfred has the hammer now, although the union can always appeal his decisions. What are your thoughts? Without knowing the specifics of what the punishment's going to be, what are your thoughts on this?
I think that the big difference here is that you're punishing the end user. You're punishing the player itself, which should be a bigger disincentive to cheating. I think before, how they were trying to treat it in 2017, and this is the reason that Luno was really the focus of the investigation and Hinch, was that they were trying to go after leadership and say, okay, it's up to the general managers to be sure that their teams are abiding by the rules. And they didn't necessarily have a mechanism to punish the players. So, and there's two parts you have to remember about this with the Astros not getting punished. One is that obviously Manfred granted them immunity as they started the investigation. But two, part of the reason he granted the immunity wasn't just to get better cooperation out of them. It was also because it wasn't clear that Manfred would be able to punish the players for the cheating in 2017. The rules weren't very strict and ironclad yet. Yeah. So there are a whole lot of reasons that the Astros players, as well as other players who cheated on other teams in 2017, didn't get punished for it. But when it comes to actually eradicating it, think about like the war on drugs. Okay, the war on drugs was largely unsuccessful in a lot of ways, especially if we talk about marijuana. Partly because, look, it was never politically tenable that you were going to go after end users a whole lot. It became like, we're going to go after the pushers. We're going to go after the dealers. And that way we'll cut it off at the source. And then if you'd actually really wanted to stop drug use, if you started sending people to prison, like all people from all walks of life, senators' sons, influential business people's sons, anybody that got caught with a bag of weed, if you sent them to jail for a long time, it probably would have been a lot more effective. But that's never going to happen because too many of these senators' sons and business people's sons and other influential, successful people like smoking weed. Yeah. So you go after the dealers, it's not actually all that effective.
Right.
So I think likewise, you go after Luno, fine, but if you're not punishing the players, it's not going to be all that effective.
Yeah, it's not a traditional power structure in baseball or in sports. The players have a lot of power, and I think what we learned in the Astros scandal is that, yeah, while Luno and Hinch are the ones that took the fall, they were, I mean, other than Hinch letting it happen, and Hinch could have stopped it. I don't want to completely absolve Hinch of any wrongdoing because he could have exercised some leadership and done his best to stop it. He thought it was in the best interest to ignore it at the time, and maybe he felt like that would have been something that would have brought down the clubhouse, or maybe deep down he felt like this was something that was helping them. Who knows? But the fact of the matter is the guys that had the power in that clubhouse for the Astros were guys like Carlos Beltran, who was cooking this scheme up. Guys like Springer, Correa, Bregman, not so much Altuve. Guys who were using the scheme to... It's the classic thing in all these sports, Seth. Like the highly paid athletes, we learn this from guys forcing their way out of situations. Athletes are learning more and more. They have the hammer. They have the good ones, the great ones. And there were some great athletes that were using this scheme right now. Hinch, I guess, felt powerless to stop it. So, yeah, now you're at least with this punishing the genesis of it. I don't think Hinch walked into the clubhouse one day and said, guys, guess what? Here's this garbage can. Guess what we're going to do? They started doing it, and then he just felt uncompelled to stop it for whatever reason.
Well, and that's where, because they started the spreadsheet and the program up in the front office, or the front office employees that were using it, the players grew restless with it, right? And Carlos Beltran thought it wasn't effective enough, so the players took it upon themselves to start the high-tech trash can banging.
Yes,
which
high-tech.
I'm still, every time I bring it up, I'm still incredulous that it actually worked for as long as it did. It's like you got a bunch of people complaining. They're like, hey, the Astros, this was just too far. Well, what'd they do? They banged on a trash can that everybody in the stadium could hear to alert us of a pitch. Oh, okay, well, why didn't you figure it out? No.
Yeah. I feel like they should punish the other teams for being stupid and letting it go on for as long as it did.
I'm not excusing it at all. It's just comical. I wish more people could see the humor in it. Yeah. It was a trash can.
Yeah.
It's the most ridiculous and absurd thing that people are painting out as, you know, Sean, in a way, it's almost kind of disappointing because I think for a long time there have been rumors about, almost to the point where I feel like people think that teams are using satellite technology to steal signs and transmit it. And you're talking about buzzers and all this stuff.
Right.
Like buzzers. You know, people thought a piece of confetti on Reddick was a buzzer. That's how crazy people are. And they're convinced that it's all this high-tech wizardry. When actually, no, it's nothing more than banging on a garbage can in conjunction with a camera and a video feed. But that's still... that's technology you could have used in the 80s.
The NFL Top 100, as voted on by the players, is in the books. It is fully released. Do we learn anything from these lists? Do we learn anything about the perception of Bill O'Brien by players from these lists? That's next. Seth, I was kind of laughing last night. The NFL Network announced the final 10 players in the NFL Top 100. They announced the top 10. They've been kind of releasing 20 players per night all week, you know, 20 or 30. I think they did one night. They've been doing it over a four-night period, and they got to the end last night, and they released the top 10. In reverse order, Derrick Henry, Stephon Gilmore, DeAndre Hopkins is eighth on the list, George Kittle, seventh, Christian McCaffrey, sixth, Michael Thomas of the Saints, fifth, Patrick Mahomes, fourth, Aaron Donald, third, Russell Wilson, two, and according to the players voting in the NFL Top 100, the best player in football heading into 2020 is Lamar Jackson, the reigning MVP and quarterback for the Baltimore Ravens. And I had to chuckle because I brought up the NFL Top 100 with McClain yesterday, and I know you brought up, you gave kind of your take just in general on the concept of the NFL Top 100. And we'll dig into a couple little elements of it here in a second. But I found it funny, and I thought about your take on it last night, where I saw people bringing up Mahomes being fourth on this list about how, oh, this is going to put a chip on his shoulder heading into 2020. Let me tell you that he's fourth on here, and he's only the third best quarterback. This must have been they must have counted up the votes before the playoffs last year, I got to tell you, because Patrick Mahomes should be really angry over being fourth. I'm like, my guess is Patrick Mahomes does not give – I don't want to say. Maybe he does. Maybe – we know these guys use different things for fuel. Maybe it is. I just had to chuckle, like, if this is what's driving Patrick Mahomes, a snub of three spots at the top of the NFL Top 100, then, man, life is good for Patrick Mahomes.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah, it doesn't seem like in all the stories you hear about Tom Brady kind of keeping things in his memory banks to use as fuel or use as a chip on his shoulder. I don't know if, like, rankings on lists like these ever really is because you don't get to take this out on somebody. The fun thing is to remember things that people criticize you for, or when somebody said like a specific player is better than you, you go out and you take it out on them. With quarterbacks, it's never this quarterback versus that quarterback because they're not facing each other on the field. I mean, that's a little bit a part to it. It's just that like these change from year to year, especially with quarterbacks, whether it's players voting on it or fans from week to week. You know, at any given point during the season, people would be convinced that, like, oh, this guy's the best player. The Lamar Jackson for much of last season was widely considered to be the future of the NFL and that nobody was ever going to be as good as him, and it's just incredible. And, boy, Pat Mahomes has taken a little bit of a step back this year.
Yeah.
You know, it's because of injury, but he's taken a little bit of a step back. He's not as awesome as he was last year. And then all of a sudden you flip it over. I do find it interesting that Lamar Jackson is number one despite his horrendous playoff performances. I give him a pass on his rookie year. He'd only been playing for a little while, and you know they didn't actually have the offense that was installed for him. But the Titans were able to make Lamar Jackson uncomfortable in that game. we know from years and years of watching football that you got to give quarterbacks a few years to figure out exactly what you have in them. The difference between Lamar Jackson and Pat Mahomes is that Pat Mahomes can do it in multiple different ways. With his arm, you know, he can run well enough to create with his legs. He's the complete package. There's still things to be found out about him, but if I had to handicap right now between Pat Mahomes and Lamar Jackson, who's going to have the better decade over the course of the next 10 years, I'm putting all my money on Pat Mahomes.
No question.
There's just flat out, he does too many things too well and too exceptionally for me to take Lamar Jackson, who is awesome and is incredible, and I don't want to have to game plan for him, but he's just not as complete a package as Pat Mahomes is.
I think very little surprise here if you're a Texan fan as to which players on the Texans crack this list. I think there's only three that you could have reasonably said before the top 100, and I even made predictions on these three and where they would fall. And I got a lot of replies to people. What about Zach Cunningham? Like, Seth, as you and I have pointed out many times, respect of this nature takes more than one good year at a position like inside linebacker to get into a thing like the NFL Top 100 that's voted on by your peers. The three Texans who made it, Laremy Tunsil, 66th on the list. I found that interesting because he's ahead of Ronnie Stanley, who's 74th on the list. These are players voting on this. J.J. Watt, 45th on the list. That's injuries. Obviously, it's keeping him down in the 40s. And then Deshaun Watson, my prediction for Deshaun was that he would move into the top 20 this year. I was right, barely. He's 20th on the list. He's the seventh quarterback on the list.
Yeah, I think with Deshaun, it's simply a matter of consistency. And the problem last year was that his bad games were really bad. You know, when the offense shut down, it seemed to shut down totally and completely. And that's where there's just a difference right now. And I think that's what Bill O'Brien is hoping to give him, is more tools in his tool belt that, depending on what kind of a defense you're facing that week, you're going to have multiple solutions to the problems that that defense presents you. At times last year, it just felt like he didn't have enough tools, you know, and part of that's on him. Part of it's on the offense. Part of it's on the wide receivers. When Deshaun holds onto the ball too long, there are times where it's him. There are times where it's because nobody is open. And is that because of the wide receiver talent? Is that because of the design of the offense? The answer is sometimes it's a little bit of each. And they're trying to take that next step forward this year. I think that if Deshaun could simply be, even if his highs weren't as high, if he were more consistent from week to week, I think that he's going to vault himself up into that top 10. Like, that's the one thing that's holding him back from being a top 5 quarterback, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
And some of that was perhaps simply just how many different receiving threats does he have in any given week. This year, that at least should be better, even if his very best wide receiving threat is gone.
He's got as good a sizzle reel as anybody. I think that helps him. You know, his highlight reel is phenomenal, and sometimes images are what make votes like this. I think what's interesting about this top 100, and Seth and I are going through the NFL top 100 here from a Texan slant with this thing, is that I mentioned Watson at 20, Watt at 45. I did mention Hopkins being at 8. Tyrann Mathieu, 39. Jadeveon Clowney, 41. So Mathieu and Clowney both ahead of J.J. Watt on this list. Again, I think it's injuries with Watt. I do find it intriguing that Clowney, coming off a 3-sack season where he was a little banged up too, is ahead of J.J. Watt on this list. But the reason I bring that up, Seth, is that those are five either current or very recent Houston Texans. So what you're telling me is that in 2018, the Texans had what wound up being five of the top 45 players in football within the next year on their team at that time. You know what I mean? That's pretty sport. Like, if you look back now, you go, man, did that 2018 team maybe underachieve a little bit?
Well, no, I think the problem with the Texans, for a long time has been that they were top heavy.
Yeah.
They have really good players at the top, but then they were decrepit at the middle class. And then it was some of the role players, the special teams, until the last few years, the special teams players weren't good enough. And I think that's the problem that Bill O'Brien has identified, and you know, he obviously wasn't happy with the way the two previous GMs were getting it done. That's why he wants these layers of players, which I agree with that philosophy. I don't think you should necessarily be overpaying the layers and layers of players to get there. You do need some stars on your team. But yeah, that does make total sense. As far as Clowney and his worth as a player, nobody's ever going to be satisfied with or I say a lot of people just don't want to accept that Clowney's a really good football player. The problem with Clowney, though, is that he's a really good football player who has a very hard value to determine because he brings a whole lot of things to the table that aren't necessarily rewarded as much as just flat-out ability to rush the passer.
Yeah.
Which is just, that's the way it works. Same way tight ends don't get rewarded financially as much as they should when you're a really good tight end. That's just the going market rate right now. For what Clowney is, he's a unique player.
Yeah.
Sean, I think I told this analogy to you before, but it's like in the housing market. Like if you want to sell a house, like developers know this, you do your standard 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath in a certain type of neighborhood where there are a lot of people looking for that type of home.
Right.
Like if it's a starter home community, you build starter homes because that's what people are looking for. If all of a sudden you decide like, well, no, I'm going to build like a kick-ass house. It's only going to have 1 bedroom. Everything else is going to be all open, and we're going to have like a luxurious outhouse that's separate. Like incredibly unique. It might be the coolest house ever. You're not going to get your money back on that house because it's so far outside of the market of what people are looking at. Clowney is that luxurious house with some kind of strange outhouse in it.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's actually looking for it and doesn't want to pay for it, even though they acknowledge that it's really, really cool what it does.
Yeah,
He's like a bidet in Iowa. Nobody in Iowa is looking for a bidet. They barely wipe their asses
you
there.
You just compared Clowney to something that washes your butt?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But does it better than anything? Like a bidet. If you're you go to Pittsburgh, yeah. I don't know how many people are. Or just any brand. I guess most places in America. I don't think most places are looking for a bidet. You go to Pasadena. What's the market in Pasadena for bidets? Probably not all that much. Clowney's a hell of a bidet, but nobody's looking for it and don't want to pay for it.
Seth, you say that, but remember one of the big markets that was supposed to be a booming market at the beginning of the pandemic? It was the bidet market, wasn't it? So
yeah,
you're not touching things and touching...
No. It's because nobody had any toilet paper.
Oh, that's why it was. That's why it was. Yes.
Yeah.
It was the toilet paper. Yeah, I thought it was touching
on Amazon.
Toilet handles and stuff.
Let me see on Amazon real quick.
That's
how
right.
Well
it was the toilet. It was the great toilet paper shortage. Yes.
Let's see. This bidet accessory has been marked down from $109 to $39. So there's no more price gouging on bidets like there once was.
The bottom's falling out of the bidet market. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. this top 100 thing. I enjoy stuff like this. I enjoy lists like this. I do find them interesting. Even if they're a little wonky in their logic sometimes. For example, the two players right in front of J.J. Watt on this thing. Jimmy Garoppolo is 43, and Mark Ingram is 44. Mark Ingram, the aging running back for the Baltimore Ravens, is considered the 44th best player by his peers, and J.J. Watt is considered the 45th best player, to which my response is, okay, so I guess in theory then the Texans should call the Ravens and see if they can somehow mind trick the Ravens into taking J.J. Watt for Mark Ingram. Like, are you kidding me? Like, Mark Ingram's a better player than J.J. Watt. I do think Seth, sometimes this list, this NFL Top 100, has some value is when you look at where a guy ranks on it year to year. Because in a weird way, it kind of tells the story of their career. I mean, even though it's not always accurate, like within the 4 or 5 guys that they're being compared to within that year. Like JJ's a better player than Garoppolo. I think he's better than Clowney. I think he's better than Matthew. But he's 45th because he was injured. If you look at JJ's trajectory in this Top 100... He entered the list at 5th coming off of 2012, his first defensive player of the year. Then the next year, he's 12th. That was the year the Texans were awful, but he was pretty good. Then he shoots all the way up to 1st. He was the best player in this thing in the year where he got all those MVP votes. And he's 3rd the next year. Then the next year, he's 35th. He's coming off of, oh, yeah, that's right. He was coming off of back surgery. Yeah. The next year, he's 84th. Oh, yeah, that's right. He had the leg injury. He had 2 injuries. Then the next year, he's 12th. Oh, yeah, that was his comeback year. And now this year he's 45th, kind of back in that little sort of middle of the pack thing because of a pectoral injury. If you were to draw a graph of everywhere where JJ's been in this NFL top 100, it really does kind of line up with what the story of his career has been, you know? And yeah. My guess is it does that with other guys, too. It just shows trajectories and ebbs and flows and things
that. You know, the thing with J.J. when he was the number one player then, you know, like right in the middle of all of his defensive MVPs, I hesitate to say this because there's almost no way to say it where it sounds petty on one way or on one hand, and I don't intend it to be that way at all. But I'll say that I think that peak J.J. Watt is still better than peak Aaron Donald. You know, and Aaron Donald is in his peak right now, only in that both of them are incredible, phenomenal talents. Both of them are just absolute specimens when it comes to the things they can do on a football field. I think the thing that sets J.J. apart in terms of prime J.J. versus prime Aaron Donald has a tendency to cruise when he's getting double and triple teamed. Like, he'll play his responsibilities, but he doesn't just say, screw it all to hell, I don't care what you're doing to me, I'm going to make some plays. There's times where he's kind of like, all right, well, I guess this is going to be that kind of game. I'm getting double teamed. I'm going to wait for my opportunity and then make a play. Where with J.J., when he was in his prime, he'd be getting double or triple teamed, and it didn't matter. Like, he was still putting out and still producing. And it was just enough that one little bit extra that I've seen out of just nobody ever defensively, at least along the defensive line. Like, as long as I've been watching football closely since 1993, my first year in college, I've never seen a human being play defensive line that way.
It's a great point.
I haven't seen anybody play quite the way Aaron Donald does either. Yeah. It's just that J.J. is just a notch above Aaron Donald in my opinion.
If you go back and look at those seasons you're talking about with J.J., we'll call it 2012 through 2015. Like, those, those are his killer years. You go back and look at the game logs, there's rarely a game where J.J. doesn't just have a sea of crooked numbers on the game. I mean, knocking down passes, tackles, TFLs, QB hits. Rare is there a game where JJ's line is like 1-1-0-0-1. Yeah. The lines are all like 5-4-3-8. You know what I mean? Just whatever stat you want to pick, he's racking up numbers. And you're right, that's with him getting double and triple team for big portions of those games.
I would say the other common theme between those two right there is a guy who was a former defensive line coach, I think, doesn't get enough credit, is Wade Phillips' influence on a lot of that. Like, Wade Phillips has been very good for Aaron Donald and J.J. Watt.
No doubt.
Because Wade Phillips, when Wade Phillips has a stud football player, he figures out ways to get that guy opportunities. And that's where I don't know if either of them will ever, like, I don't know if Aaron Donald's ever going to have the same statistical output he's had over the last couple of, over the last several years, you know, without Wade Phillips.
Yep. A text message: seems like the Ravens all got together and decided to vote for the NFL top 100. That's true. Lamar Jackson, number one overall, and as I mentioned, Mark Ingram, 44 ahead of J.J. Watt.
One of our listeners pointed out that the voting for this is done same week as the Pro Bowl, so that would make sense that Lamar Jackson at that point was considered a better quarterback than Patrick Mahomes, or at least for last season.
Okay.
If you take the regular season awards, Lamar Jackson was a better regular season quarterback than
Patrick
Mahomes.
Well, Jackson had been knocked out of the playoffs at that point, though. You know, like, he, you know,
Mahomes
had
during Pro Bowl voting is 2 weeks before the
end. I thought you meant the voting took place the week of the actual Pro Bowl game.
It took place
in conjunction with the Pro Bowl voting.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. All right. As we head into the 9 o'clock hour, look, I like Dusty Baker, but was last night the first time where the warning signs that we got about Dusty Baker came back to roost? That's next.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend, or do something a little more epic? and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.